This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson. As always, thanks for tuning in. If you look around Detroit these days, you can't help but notice neighborhood change. Specific, physical neighborhood change. Things like bike lanes and new apartments and bars. Things that we haven't seen in lots of parts of Detroit for a really long time. And although the term is used really broadly, gentrification generally means economic development injected into a specific neighborhood at the cost of displacing poorer residents who are already living there. Is that what we're seeing in Detroit? Can we think of places where people are essentially being moved out in favor of other people moving in, maybe people with more money, people with different colored skin? Or is it more complex than that? Is something else really going on? Let's be clear. Everybody wants development in their neighborhood. Everybody wants to live in a stable community with trees and parks and bars and grocery stores. Detroiters have longed for those things for a really long time. If you think back to what the city was in the 70s and the 80s, how easy it was, even as dark as some of those times were, to live here in neighborhoods, and how we lost so much of that in the late 80s and the 90s, which were devastating years for Detroit. How do we get back to that? And how do we get back to it for the people who have lived here for all that time? The African Americans who make up the majority of the city's population. Why do cities struggle to solve these problems for the people who live in them? And why doesn't the presence of new people with more money end up translating into better things for the people who are already there? How come it means in some cases that those folks who were there, poor and working class people, get driven out? In a new piece in The Atlantic, staff writer Jerusalem Demzas wrote about what she sees as the real problem plaguing cities. She says, people who prevent developers from building more homes and different kinds of homes are also preventing low and working class people from climbing the economic ladder. Essentially, she says, housing policy and bad housing policy makes all of these problems look worse. To explain why that's true, here with us is Jerusalem Demzas. Jerusalem, welcome to Detroit Today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I want to start with a question that doesn't get asked a lot, and I alluded to it in my open there. What is gentrification, and is gentrification always what we're seeing when we see neighborhood change and demographic change in cities like Detroit?
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic question because I think it, as you alluded, it's something that it's a word that we use a lot to describe a lot of different types of change. To give a concrete definition, this is one that the Urban Displacement Project, which is a research and policy group at UC Berkeley, defines. They say that gentrification is, quote, a process of neighborhood change that includes economic change in historically disinvested neighborhood by means of real estate investment and newer higher income residents moving in, as well as demographic change, not only in terms of income level, but also in terms of the changes of education level of racial makeup of residents. So essentially, it involves new investment, either private or public, and new residents coming in, and that those new residents may usually indicate a change in demographics. So often they're higher educated, they're often white or non-Black. And so I think that that's kind of what we have as a real general definition. But I think what you allude to in your opener is that often what we've started saying is that gentrification is anytime change occurs and that there is some sort of transaction cost. And those can be the transaction costs that come with regular interactions with people that become more fraught because you don't have a long history with them. It can be the people that are moving into your neighborhood don't understand the cultural cues or norms of your community, and that therefore there's friction. Sometimes that stuff is racist. Sometimes it's when people assume that you don't live there because this is now an up-and-coming neighborhood, but your family's been there for a long time. Sometimes it can even elevate to the level of police involvement, where the newcomers may view what is community norms as disorder, and they weaponize the police in order to change the neighborhood. So I think that often what we're talking about here is this question of, you know, how do we define what types of change are good or bad, and who gets to say which of those things are good and bad, and then when those things have to be resolved, how do we resolve them? Like, who has the power to say, you know, it's worth it to have a new Whole Foods here because that means we have more access to fresh groceries, but perhaps that Whole Foods displays something that other people in the community liked. And so I think that this entire conversation is just what we're trying to, is all of us trying to define gentrification and you know, often failing to do so in a way that we can get agreement across lots of people.
And one of the things that I think is really key to the observation and the argument that you're making here is you are not saying carte blanche that it's a bad thing to welcome new people into cities, to welcome development, to welcome housing that maybe is more expensive than what already exists in the area, that it's too narrow to just think of the problem in those terms.
Yeah, I mean, just more specifically here, I think often people want to put the onus on the demand side of the equation. So they say the problem is new people who want to come into the city, new businesses that want to form here that are different than the old businesses. And what I'm trying to say is that we should want to create a world where there is an abundance of possibility for a bunch of different people to exist. The problem is not that there are young urban professionals who are higher educated and often more white who want to enter into these communities. The problem is that our communities are set up to only allow a certain number of people to benefit from the gains of growth. So what I mean by this is, let's say, a bunch of new people want to move to a new neighborhood that's economically and racially diverse. If that neighborhood plans for growth, if they increase the number of homes that are available, if they make sure that there are buses and sidewalks and transit that is available to a growing population, then that growth is positive. You have more people who can have access to a city. You see a greater tax base for that community that they can then reinvest in public goods like education and transportation and other things that are important. But what we often see is that communities and city officials don't plan for growth. And when that happens, you're setting up conflict between newcomers and oldcomers instead of designing a city that can actually accommodate everyone. And so often what we see is that people place the blame on what they see, the visible change, right? They see the change of new people coming in. But the real problem is that no one is planning for a growing population. And I think that it's really harmful for us to say that, you know, people who already live somewhere get to decide that no one else can come there. We have a history in this country of that sort of thinking, excluding poor individuals, excluding Black and brown families from access to important neighborhoods. And that's what we see today, which is that the mass majority of neighborhoods are not gentrifying in urban locales. They're actually pretty stagnant. You see segregated single family home neighborhoods that are exclusive to very wealthy people and often white people, and that are the descendants of redlining and other forms of intentional segregation. The other flip side of the coin, these neighborhoods that are areas of concentrated poverty. I mean, this is a really big problem in Detroit, where these neighborhoods have no access to public or private investment. They don't even have the problem of managing new growth and dealing with gentrification. They have a much harder problem of concentrated poverty. And so I think that the bigger question here is not, are there pains that come with new people and new businesses coming to your neighborhood? It's how do we manage that? Because if we reject it, we're going to get to a place of segregation and stagnation and poverty.
I'm talking with Jerusalem Demzas. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and her recent piece is titled "The Real Villain in the gentrification story. We're talking about demographic change here in the city of Detroit and in Southeast Michigan, what it looks like, what it means, what it's caused by, what it's causing, and how we might think differently about all of that in a way that might bring more opportunity and investment to people, poor people, African Americans, who in our region have long suffered without. How do we revive parts of the city of Detroit where people have lived for a long time without really basic access to necessities that any of us would want in the places where we live? Is the answer more people moving in who have more means into those neighborhoods and creating mixed income kinds of communities where the wealthier people's presence attracts the kind of amenities and services that everybody can benefit from? Or is there a different way? Should we be wary of new people moving into neighborhoods here in Detroit? As always, we want to have you participate in the conversation here. Give us a call and talk about what's changing around you and your community. What part of Detroit do you notice a big change in terms of who's there, in terms of what's there, in terms of what's happening in those communities? What do you think of the way in which the city's changing, and who is it changing to benefit? Do you feel like the benefits are accruing to the people who are moving in, the new people that we see in many different parts of Detroit? Or do you think that the whole city benefits, that the growth in the tax base that they are helping to build and other things mean that things are maybe getting better, but maybe there's a lag in those outcomes? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page, put comments there, or you can go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation that way. I want to start today with Alberta in Detroit. Alberta, welcome to the show.
Well, good morning, Stephen. This is Alberta, Kinsley Talabi.
Hey, how are you?
Yes, she is absolutely on point. I live in one of those neighborhoods over here on Pennsylvania, the home that my parents purchased over 80 years ago, and I'm still here. At one time, there were 40 houses on my block. Today, there are only 6.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that many of those homes were destroyed. There's no one reason. But let me say this. Yes, my neighborhood is experiencing a lot of diversity now. And I feel that the city needs to put emphasis on building more affordable housing and low-income housing. People don't even talk about low-income anymore. And let me just give you an example. This past Saturday, one of my new neighbors, and I hadn't met her. She'd been here for over a year. And I kept saying, I got to knock on her door and let her know that I'm the person and behind her, and that, you know, she can see my back and I can see her side of her house. And if anything happens, she needs my number and I need hers. Well, over a year, and I never did that. Well, guess what? This Saturday, she was out running her beautiful dog, some kind of doodle. Anyway, and another dog, my neighbor's dog, got out, and this woman had the neighbor's dog in one hand and her dog, and trying to keep this dog from eating her dog up, okay? And without thinking, I was taking my bike out. I jumped down the stairs, ran over, and grabbed my neighbor's dog, okay? Who could have turned on me? But that wasn't even a question. This woman needed help, and I thank God I was there to provide that assistance.
Huh. Yeah.
So, at the end of the day, we have to create an environment where everyone is included and no one's left out. And yes, there are a lot of Detroiters who have stuck and stayed, and we should be benefiting.
Yeah.
And yes, the income or the housing values have gone up. My only concern is that not enough of us are benefiting.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Alberta, as always, it's great to hear from you. And you know, you and I have talked before about the story of your block and your neighborhood and how it is, you know, exhibit A of the change that we've seen in the city over a really long period of time. Jerusalem, before you answer, I'll also tell you that Alberta was a member of our city council and then a member of our state legislature. So she's somebody who really does understand how policy drives a lot of these changes. I want to have you respond specifically to the housing question, though, mm-hmm. that she raises, this idea of building affordable housing and setting policy in a way that makes it possible to build affordable housing while you are also welcoming new people who might be building more expensive housing. That, according to you and your piece, is one of the real keys to preventing gentrification or, you know, significant demographic change when you're welcoming new people to a city.
Yeah, so I think that this is the heart of the problem, is just what is the city's housing problem. And Detroit, obviously, let me just say this. There are two problems when we think about folks who can't afford housing. There is the problem of there isn't existing housing available for them. And then there's a secondary problem of they don't have enough money. And both things have to be attacked, right? So on the one hand, on the supply side, we need to be building new affordable housing for people, because we want folks not to just live in deteriorating housing stock. We want them to be living in places that are accessible, that have energy efficient infrastructure and safety innovations that have occurred over the last few decades. And often housing stock across the country is extremely old, and especially for folks who are on the lower end of the rental market, it's very, very old apartments and homes that they're renting or considering buying. And so I think that the first thing here is, how do we get enough development of these units possible? And I think that that's a part of that, is to let the private market handle folks who are on the upper end. So, you know, I don't think that we need to have government intervention for people who make a lot of money. But on the other hand, I do think there needs to be government investment in affordable housing for folks who are not going to be able to pay that much in rent. And that's because those are people for whom the private market is not going to solve, that is maybe not going to be able to afford to the projects won't pencil out if you can only pay like $500 a month in rent or below. And so what that means is that the government needs to invest in providing rental vouchers. I think this is something that is growing in popularity, is making housing vouchers universally available. This is true across the country, that people wait years after they have qualified for a housing voucher to actually receive that. And then when they do, the process is so difficult and so onerous, they often can lose it before being able to actually use it. And that is a huge problem. So making that universally available is the first thing. And that's something the federal government really needs to do. And then the second thing is just, I think the government at local level can actually invest in affordable housing by working with affordable housing developers to make sure that they have access to new lots. They have access to funding and financing in order to be able to develop. But often when I'm talking to affordable housing developers across the country, the biggest obstacle they often face in building affordable housing and in low-income housing is the politics of the local environment that they're in. People, and this is something that happened in Los Angeles recently, as they approved $1 billion for affordable housing development, but people don't want that housing development in their neighborhood, or they have thoughts about what it should exactly look like, how many people they're willing to have there. And this process of trying to actually figure out a site to develop that housing, often it's homelessness housing, elderly housing, low-income housing, is so costly because it costs so much delays, it costs all these lawyers, you have to have all these extensive meetings, and it drives up the cost of development to the point where it becomes impossible for even affordable housing developers who have the backing of the city, who have the backing of $1 billion in investment to build that those units. And so in Los Angeles, very few units have gotten built. This measure was approved over 6 years ago, and it was supposed to be building 10,000 units over 10 years, and they haven't even come close to half of that. And so this is one of the situations where I think that we need to really think clearly about what processes are we developing at the local level to make sure that when we're trying to develop affordable housing and low-income housing, that we're actually making it possible to build that easily and quickly, and not really default towards these long, onerous conversations about, you know, the very best place to put it, because it's really a crisis right now. And in crisis times, we have to move quickly.
Yeah. Okay, when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about demographic change, about gentrification, about housing and housing policy. Also, continue to hear from you guys on the phones and on social media. Jerry in Detroit, Ryan in Harrison Township, Levi in Southfield. We'll get to you next. If you want to join them, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET is your connection to what's happening in Detroit.
WDET is your place for open dialogue about the issues that impact you.
Stay in the know.
This is WDET FM,
Detroit's NPR station.
You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. We're talking about demographic change here in Detroit and in Southeast Michigan. My guest is Jerusalem Demzas, a staff writer for The Atlantic, who recently wrote a piece called The Real Villain in the Gentrification Story. We're talking about housing policy as well and the ways in which it influences those things. As always, we want to hear from you on the phones and on social media. 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook or Twitter, put the comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation. Let's go to Jerry in Detroit next. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Stephen and Jerusalem.
Hey.
Hi.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the neighborhood that's changing, you know, near me.
Mm-hmm.
Are you at all familiar with the West Village neighborhood on the Near East Side?
Sure. Next to Indian Village, yes.
Yes, there's a lot of new businesses popping up there. There's this new apartment that just went up on the corner of Kirchhoffville and Van Dyke.
Mm-hmm.
And my feelings about gentrification, you know, I really, really don't mind, you know, whether or not it's gentrified, because we needed a lot of new people in the neighborhood. And plus, there are a lot of, you know, new businesses that have popped up in the neighborhood, places like there are some African-American owned places in the neighborhood,
sure.
Places like Detroit Vegan Soul. There's this other place called Sister Pie, wonderful place,
mm-hmm.
Owned by Lisa Ludwinski. A great place. It was a neighborhood that I spent some of my early childhood on. My family had lived there until we lived on Van Dyke, until we moved to Bewick Street in the early 1970s. This was when I was a very small child. What I noticed in the neighborhood is that it's not just mostly white people moving back in. It's younger whites,
mm-hmm.
and they definitely have a little bit of an entrepreneurial spirit, and I think they've believe in the city, and I think in some ways it is good for the neighborhood to come back, because it's been down for such a long time.
Yeah. Jerry, you're absolutely right about what's going on over there and how dynamic it is and how much it feels different from the way it did just, you know, a summer ago or two summers ago. You know, the test, I think, over there is, again, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, what do the demographics in that neighborhood look like? You know, does it maintain, access for people who are not wealthy? Does it maintain access for people who are not white? And by that, I don't mean in a legal sense, but certainly in a cultural sense. And I don't know what the kind of particular data points are there about that, or what the particular levers that need to be pulled are. But I think that is the question we kind of got to ask about it. And Jerusalem, maybe you can talk about that, not just that particular neighborhood, which you may not be familiar with, but this dynamic. Again, there's a lot going on in a short period of time, a lot of money all of a sudden concentrating on one area. How do you make sure that people are not squeezed out of the progress?
Yeah, no, I think this is the exact right question to be asking, because as you mentioned, these people who are moving in, often they're really committed there to the neighborhood. They're excited about living in a city environment. They're willing to give back to their community. And I think directing that energy in a productive way and making sure that it's in concert with folks who may be more marginalized in terms of access to capital or access to government institutions is what's really important here. And there are ways that you can do this. I think one of the ways to do this is that you have you make sure that there is more access given to long-standing residents, whether it's for capital, but if they say that there's important historical areas near them, making sure you have a process of understanding what those important places are before and as this change occurs so that you don't have losses of really important institutions. I think also like cultivating public spaces where there's diversity is really important. So making sure that, you're having events or block parties or things like that where people come together across different community lines and you have, politicians who are there, who are working, you have community leaders and nonprofits who are there, who are making sure that it's a process of integration. Because I do think that the big thing we're talking about here that often is not named is that this is the only way that America has integrated is in the process of gentrification. And we have not done it in the best way possible, obviously, because a lot of people have been left out of those gains. But I think that is the big issue here is how do we actually do integration in an equitable way? And also recognizing that some of the change is going to be uncomfortable, that perhaps if you were used to living in a community that used to look one way and it starts to grow, even if no one gets displaced, you might see a lot more people from a different racial background than you're used to seeing in that area. And that might feel weird or strange for some period of time because that's actually what integration usually does feel like.
Yeah.
I think the thing that's important to keep in mind is for officials and leaders in these communities to constantly be pointing to the benefits that this brings and also to point to what the flip side is, which is segregated communities, which is what we've seen for most of American history, what we see mostly across the American landscape now, and implementing policies that are, providing jobs to lower income folks, making sure that the people who get access to the new work that is provided by these new businesses, that they are maybe preferencing individuals who are in those communities. There are a bunch of different ways to be doing this. And I think that the biggest thing, though, is, of course, we've talked about is on the housing side, is making sure that there is high quality, affordable housing for everyone in these places. So not just lower income people who are currently there can move to these neighborhoods, but that when neighborhoods start to grow and people see it as a place they want to move to, that the only people who can move there can't just be rich people, that poorer individuals can move there too, that can get access to those new neighborhoods that are vibrant, that have access to transit, that have access to, new private investment. Those things are really important. And so I think that a combination of just government engagement in this process of integration and making sure places like nonprofits or churches or other community institutions are involved as well, and not just viewing all change as bad, is what's really important here.
Yeah. Okay. Jerusalem Demzas, we could continue this conversation for many hours today, and our callers are backed up too, trying to get into the conversation. But I want to thank you for being here. It was really great to have you for this talk.
Yeah, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Yeah, and to the callers that we did not get to, a reminder that we're going to come back to this subject over and over again, because of the change that we are experiencing here in the city of Detroit. So thanks for calling, and don't forget to listen again, and maybe next time you'll get in. Okay, that's going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow when we'll talk with Bryce Covert about her article in the New York Times asking why we have more anti-poverty policies for elders than we do for children. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.